And it's happening. With regard to the U.S. Claiming that they would pull out of the Paris Agreement, I remember when that news came in over a year ago, and how I think it actually gave more resolve to people who have a job to do, and that's to make a transition to a more sustainable economy. It's like those of us outside of the U.S. are like, okay, well, we have more work to do. Will we get there? Will we meet the Paris Agreement? That's a big question.
Jason Bach, I want to thank you for being with us. Professor of Glaciology at the Geologic Survey of Denmark and Greenland, speaking to us from Copenhagen. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Hang around. Letters and Politics next.
KBOO Radio builds media makers. We believe strong, resilient communities must know how to make their own media. For the last 50 years, KBOO has trained thousands of people how to produce compelling radio. We know that with our expertise and your support, we can keep this city activated and aware through radio. Invest in Portland's future media makers and join KBOO on Kickstarter today.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Do you have questions about KBOO's Kickstarter campaign? What's the Kickstarter, you ask? We are doing this campaign instead of a membership drive. It's an all-or-nothing campaign, which means if we don't raise the full $20,000 by March 9th, we have to send the donations back. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter to donate. We will be having our next Kickstarter live video chat on Thursday, March 1st at noon. So check us out and get all your questions answered at kboo.fm/Kickstarter.
KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This is Pacifico Radio's Letters and Politics. On today's show...
This isn't just a simple defense of existing elites. It's a much more sophisticated defense that says there's a reason why these elites now find themselves facing something like the French Revolution. Or, you know, something like the New Deal, later if we want to jump ahead. And that's that they've gotten too comfortable. And so what they need to do is they need to now battle the left, whatever the left is at any given moment in time. And through that battle and through that struggle, they will come out of it stronger, more powerful, more capable of command, and we will have a new ruling class.
A conversation on the history of conservative philosophy and its main tenet of aristocratic rule. Our guest is Corey Robin. He's a professor of political science at Brooklyn College in the CUNY Graduate Center, and he's the author of the book, The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Donald Trump. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Senate Democrats say they want Donald Trump to follow through on his vaguely worded call for comprehensive background checks for gun buyers. They're pressing him to endorse legislation that would extend such checks to online and gun show sales. They made their case in a letter to Trump before the president hosts a meeting with a bipartisan group of lawmakers to discuss school safety and gun legislation. Heavy security at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School as classes resumed for the first time since the Valentine's Day massacre 2 weeks ago that killed 17 students and teachers. Dozens of police officers were on hand. Student David Hogg spoke to CNN, calling out politicians and the National Rifle Association.
Extremely frustrating and annoying to see Speaker Paul Ryan and multiple others not take any action. Paul Ryan wants to see more teachers be armed at our schools along with the Republican Party. They want to sell more guns. They want to work on behalf of the people that own them, which is the NRA.
Dick's Sporting Goods says it will immediately end sales of assault-style rifles in its stores and won't sell guns to anyone under the age of 21. Chairman and CEO Edward Stack said on ABC that after the Parkland, Florida massacre, the company felt it needed to do something. Stack says shooter Nicholas Cruz purchased a gun at a Dick's store, but not the one used at the school shooting. Donald Trump again has attacked Attorney General Jeff Sessions on Twitter this morning. Trump said Sessions isn't doing enough to investigate whether the FBI abused government surveillance powers in the Russia probe. Sessions announced yesterday the Justice Department's Inspector General will evaluate whether prosecutors and agents abused the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in obtaining a warrant to monitor the communications of Trump associates. Trump complained on Twitter that the Inspector General will take forever, has no prosecutorial power, and charge at the office is already late with other reports. Trump added, quote, "Isn't the IG an Obama guy? Why not use Justice Department lawyers? Disgraceful," Trump tweeted. East Bay Congressman Eric Swalwell told CNN he thought it was premature for Sessions to order such a probe by the Inspector General and said Trump was probably reacting to a whole series of setbacks.
I agree with him that it's disgraceful, but it's disgraceful because there's no evidence of any FISA abuse. So we have different problems with Jeff Sessions, but this is what it looks like when the walls start to close in. His president's son-in-law lost his security clearance yesterday. Paul Manafort was indicted for additional counts today, and I think you saw yesterday that the strategy with Hope Hicks has backfired, and so the president, as he does, is acting out.
Published reports say that the security clearance of White House senior advisor and presidential son-in-law Jared Kushner has been downgraded, significantly reducing his access to classified information. Donald Trump has given his son-in-law a wide-ranging portfolio, including Mideast peace, relations with Mexico, China, and Japan, and a host of domestic priorities. The Washington Post reported that officials in at least four countries privately discussed ways they could manipulate Kushner by taking advantage of his complex business arrangements, financial difficulties, and lack of foreign policy experience. The Post said those nations included China, Israel, Mexico, and the United Arab Emirates. Federal immigration officials say they've arrested more than 150 people in Northern California since Sunday. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials announced agents made the arrests in a three-day sweep. Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf had warned residents Saturday night that credible sources told her a sweep was coming, saying she wanted not to panic immigrants but to protect them. The acting ICE director, Thomas Homan, lambasted Schaaf, calling her warning a reckless decision based on a political agenda. Last night, Schaaf defended her decision, saying she did not regret sharing the information. Schaaf said, quote, "It is Oakland's legal right to be a sanctuary city, and we have not broken any laws. We believe our community is safer when families stay together." The ICE sweep was the second such move since a statewide sanctuary law took effect last month. ICE arrested more than 200 people earlier this month in the Los Angeles area. Santa Barbara, California authorities are urging people to flee areas devastated by last month's deadly Montecito mudslide because of a coming storm. The sheriff's office issued an evacuation warning for Goleta, Santa Barbara, Montecito, Summerlin, and Carpinteria. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we're going to be in conversation about the history of conservative philosophy and ideology. My guest is Corey Robin. Corey Robin teaches political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center, and he is the author of the book, The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Donald Trump. He joins me via Skype. Corey Robin, it's my good pleasure to welcome you to our program.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Now, this is your second edition of this book. The first edition came out, I believe, around 2011 or so. But you wanted to put out a second edition in order to incorporate the election of Donald Trump?
Yeah, I was, like a lot of people, I was very surprised by the election of Donald Trump. I had thought that Hillary Clinton would win. But unlike a lot of people, I was not at all surprised by his winning the nomination of the Republican Party. To my mind, Donald Trump was very much in keeping with a lot of historic Republican and conservative patterns. And so I was trying to figure out, and part of what inspired the new edition of the book was trying to figure out both how it was that he managed to win the election, which I hadn't anticipated, but also to try to explain to people all the ways in which he's very consistent with longstanding historical patterns. And that was, you know, one of the main inspirations for the book. There were some other ones that we can get into in a bit.
And we'll definitely get there. And I do want to take a step back and really dive into the history here. But help me see that linkage of Donald Trump to the past of conservative ideology, conservative philosophy. Many people see Donald Trump and have interpreted Donald Trump as a break from the, I guess we'll say, grand old party. Though, of course, conservatism begins before that. But how do you see that link?
Well, if you want to take the long view, conservatism is at its heart, and this is the argument of my book, a reactionary political movement and political form of thought that always is responding to, broadly speaking, emancipatory movements of the left. And by that I mean movements of subaltern or subordinate classes that are trying to emancipate themselves, that are trying to win some kind of power. That's the basis of all conservative thought going back to the French Revolution, which is when it arises. And what I discovered in writing the book was that in order to fulfill that reactionary imperative, what conservatism does is it becomes a mass mobilizing philosophy that is oftentimes very hostile to existing institutions, that is oftentimes very suspicious of traditional elites because it views them as out of touch and weak, and that is often very violent in its rhetoric and suspicious of the rule of law. And so these are characteristics that I trace in conservatism, again, going back to the French Revolution. And if, you know, if you look at Donald Trump's rhetoric and his campaign, and certainly since he's ruled, he's very consistent in that respect. So many of the things that I think people are most freaked out about with Trump are in fact quite familiar and longstanding patterns within conservatism.
So, and hence the title of your book, The Reactionary Mind. Now, Donald Trump may have broken tradition, and you can argue if actually George W. Bush or even Ronald Reagan broke tradition as well concerning issues over the debt. I guess when we bring in the religious right into conservative ideologies, broken traditions when it comes to just sort of marriage and behavior. But you're saying the one tradition that he has not broken, and which is what you could find throughout the line of conservatism throughout history, is that he's reacting to changes that are happening in society.
Yes, and by that we should be careful here. I think people get a little bit confused about this. Trump is, in my mind, kind of the tail end of a long conservative movement. As I said, this all begins with the French Revolution, but it has had sort of episodes in response to different social movements. You know, abolition, for instance, awakened conservatism in one way. The labor movement of the 1880s and the 1890s awakened it as well. And what Trump is a response to as I said, he's the sort of the tail end of a movement that has been responding both to the New Deal and the freedom struggles of the 1960s and 1970s. And so that's what he's really reacting against. It's not so much he's reacting against, you know, President Obama or something like that. It's a much broader set of changes that he is responding to, and as I say, he's the tail end of that response or reaction.
Well, that's interesting to me, because I was thinking about reacting and being a reaction to, not including but not limited it to, the presidency of Barack Obama, also the rise of Black Lives Matter, the protests that have been happening in the street, a response to maybe Occupy Wall Street, even going a little bit further back.
Yeah, I don't think that's really the case. And the reason for that is that historically, and I'm going to step back again, when conservatism is reacting to movements of actual dispossession, that is to say, a movement that really is not just in the streets, but is actually taking power and privilege away from some group of elites, however they are defined. So the French Revolution is the template for that. This was a revolution that really dispossessed an entire class of people. Likewise, abolition. Likewise, the labor movement. And I think the problem with seeing things like Black Lives Matter or even Occupy or Obama as equivalent is that none of those, although those movements have begun to make some threatening gestures that would worry elites, they have not in any way, shape, or form really achieved any kind of political traction. They don't control the state. You know, there hasn't been, you know, if we take the goals of Black Lives Matter, for instance, there hasn't been a rollback of the carceral state. There hasn't been, if we take Occupy or the Sanders campaign, there hasn't been any kind of fundamental overhaul of power under the aegis of those movements. So you could say that they are glimmerings or of the beginning of something, but they're by no means the equivalent of the previous social movements that awakened the conservative movement in the past.
How about the, and I promise we're going to get into the French Revolution and walk our way all the way back to the present. We have time to do that. So I get your point about Donald Trump. How do you feel about the rise of the alt-right?
You know, if anything, what I've seen and have read, that the alt-right has really fragmented and fractured, you know, since the election of Donald Trump. It's actually gotten significantly weaker. I mean, if you compare the alt-right to something like the backlash against the civil rights movement in the 1960s and 1970s, that was the white backlash really grew over time. It was never a small marginal movement at all. It had real access, and it transformed a political party that was able to execute its entire program. Everything we've seen about the alt-right has shown that it's actually diminished since the election of Donald Trump. Don't forget, right after that election, there was that big rally or convention in D.C. with Richard Spencer. And all those guys have really diminished in significance. They haven't transformed the Republican Party. The Republican Party looks remarkably similar today to how it looked the day before the election. And that, again, was just not the case with the white supremacist movements of the 1960s and 1970s that really completely transformed the Republican Party.
That's interesting to me, because I was thinking in preparing for our conversation, and I was reading about how the right has learned to use, and you write about this, the language from the left for its own benefit, and also in reacting to these social movements historically that happened. And you write about Phyllis Schlafly and I guess it was David Horowitz, the conservative activist, who said sort of promoted this idea of let's use their language for our own causes. And that made me think of the alt-right. That made me think of Richard Spencer and Identity Europa and some of these
sure.
alt-right groups as that's what they're doing. They're now using the same language that social justice and racial justice activists were using for themselves.
I think that is absolutely true. I wouldn't dispute at all. And as you say, this is a longstanding pattern. And so what they're doing mimics that pattern. I think where maybe we disagree, or where I depart somewhat from the way I think most people view these things, is that I don't see these movements as gaining in power where once they were. If anything, I see them diminishing. That doesn't mean that they can't be extraordinarily violent. It doesn't mean that they can't be quite harmful and do some quite a bit of damage. That I don't think is the issue. But in terms of them generating a kind of mass counter movement against the left, that I haven't seen that. If anything, every time, you know, they've tried to kind of go public and march, for instance, in Charlottesville or in Boston, or after Charlottesville also, I can't remember, Kentucky or Tennessee, they've always been met by overwhelming numbers of civil rights activists and people supporting Black Lives Matter and so forth, and they've had to turn tail and run. So I just don't see them gaining power and gaining traction. If anything, I see them diminishing.
That's an interesting point. Back to Donald Trump, it seems like it seems like now the majority of the Republican Party, at one time that seemed to despise him, now is embracing him, and those who oppose what Donald Trump stands for seems to be a smaller group within the Republican Party. But maybe what I'm hearing you saying is not that Donald Trump has overtaken the Republican Party, but he's more assimilating into it?
I think that's right. The opposition to Trump before the election, during the primary campaign, was somewhat fragmented. I mean, let's remember, he never won even a majority of the primary vote. It was always just a plurality, and in part that was because the opposition to him was so fragmented and scattered. But by September, October, before the election, the Republican Party had decided this is the guy who's going to be our nominee and we're going to support him, and they did. What's been most interesting since his inauguration is how much he has pretty much delivered on standard Republican Party issues. Let's not forget, and people do forget, I mean, the real fear about Trump was that he was going to turn the Republican Party from a kind of establishment free market party into a European style proto-fascist party. And by that was meant racist on the one hand, but economically populist on the other hand. Well, on the economic platform, he's completely gone whole hog to standard Republican Party policies. All of the promises around infrastructure, of course, have come completely to naught. That was supposed to be the bedrock of the sort of Steve Bannon style Republican administration, and it's not happened, and it's not going to happen. There were promises that they were going to increase taxes on the wealthy. They've done exactly the opposite. They've done exactly what George W. Bush did and what Ronald Reagan did. There was all kinds of promises to have a much more protectionist trade policy. Almost all of that has come to naught. He had promises of, you know, grand healthcare proposals and all the rest of it. Of course, that's come to naught. So on all the economic dimensions, he's been very standard. All of his Supreme Court and for the most part, all of his federal court nominees have been very, very standard Republican Party politics. The one area that, and then also, of course, there's all the deregulation as well. So all that's very consistent and pretty much what any Republican would have done. The one area where there's some dispute about is on immigration. And political scientists and historians, you know, really disagree about this. One could make the case that he's pushed the Republican Party towards a much more nativist position. I would argue, however, that the Republican Party was already there. I mean, let's not forget, under Obama and even under George W. Bush, there were repeated efforts to get immigration reform, and they were all defeated by the Republican Party in Congress. So Trump has pretty much become, I think people were misled by the rhetoric of George W. Bush, who was more pro-immigration, clearly, than Trump was. But the Republican Party as a whole, and especially the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, has been very hostile to immigration for a long time. So if immigration is the one area where one might say he's transformed the party, I think, you know, you have a very strong argument that he just basically has now represents what the mainstream of Republican Party positions were for quite a while.
Do you think we're just being sidetracked or by the rhetoric that comes from Trump?
I mean, I wouldn't say sidetracked. I have written a series of pieces since the election that we should pay more attention to what he does rather than what he says. And I think that advice is held up, because if you look at what he does, it's quite similar. What's interesting about the rhetoric, and this is one of the things I talk about in the book, it's that, you know, I call it the sort of the ambient violence of that rhetoric. It's very scary. It seems so hostile to institutions and all the rest of it. And again, that's pretty standard stuff on the right, and it goes way back. So we should pay attention to it insofar as it reveals him to be kind of a standard conservative. It's more extreme than things we heard in the past, but it's an extremity. It's a difference of not of kind, but just of quantity, really.
We are in conversation with Corey Robin. He is a professor of political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center, and he is the author of the book, The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Donald Trump. Okay, let's dive into this deep history. You've referenced a few times now the French Revolution, which begins in 1789. You say that's where conservatism begins, with the French Revolution. Not that the French Revolution was conservative, but the reaction against the French Revolution.
Yeah, that's right. So conservatism at its heart has a vision of what a good society is. And in that vision, it's that the best man, and it's a very masculine, vision, very patriarchal, it's that the best man or the best men govern everybody else. It's a very hierarchical and stratified vision. Now, that's not a new idea. That goes back to ancient Greece. I mean, Plato had a very similar idea, Aristotle, and so on. But what makes conservatism modern and new is that it has to articulate that vision in the context of a revolutionary or transformative social movement that has brought the masses to power. In other words, it's one thing to say the best men should rule in a situation that's very hierarchical already and very static, and everybody assumes that that's the way it should go. It's quite another thing to make that assertion and that claim in the context of something like the French Revolution, when suddenly you have all these actors in society that have not been on the political stage before demanding rights, claiming that they have a stake in society too, and that they have the right to govern themselves. And so conservatism is confronting that kind of problem of articulating a very hierarchical, elitist vision of politics in the context where the masses have been mobilized and put into motion. And so what happens then is that, and you alluded to this earlier, that conservatism needs to start making its case for hierarchy to a democratic audience. And what it does is it starts borrowing from the movement that it's opposing. And you see this in thinkers like Edmund Burke and Joseph de Maistre, Edmund Burke, people know, was a British statesman originally from Ireland, and who led the reaction against the French Revolution from Britain. And Joseph de Maistre was a very aristocratic thinker in France. And what's fascinating about them is the way they make the case for hierarchy and inequality, but in a very populist way, in ways that incorporate the mass and incorporate the subordinate classes into their vision. And that's why you have this kind of violent rhetoric, because violence and war are a way of incorporating people who exist on the lower tiers of society. It incorporates them into the polity, but without giving them much of a real sense of power. And so we see that in the reaction against the French Revolution. The other thing that we see, which I think has been really missed by a lot of people, and this leads us back to Trump and all kinds of other conservatives post-French Revolution, is that for all their defense of these hierarchies and these elites, people like Burke and de Maistre are also very, very critical of those elites. De Maistre was very critical of the church and the nobility, and Burke was very critical with time of the sort of the ruling classes of Britain. And the critique runs something like this. It's that all of you guys, with all of your wealth and your power and all of your command over society as a whole, you got complacent. You got too comfortable with all your power and with your privilege. And because you got so complacent and because you got so comfortable, you lost the art of rule. You no longer know how to rule. And in a way, the revolution was a kind of welcome verdict on your weakness and your incapacity. And why don't we now use this opportunity of this revolutionary bloodbath to purge the ruling classes of all their weaknesses and to renew them and to make them a kind of a new ruling class that can now really seize command and take control of society. And that's the reactionary part of this. So in other words, this isn't just a simple defense of existing elites. It's a much more sophisticated defense that says there's a reason why these elites now find themselves facing something like the French Revolution, or you know, something like the New Deal later, if we want to jump ahead. And that's that they've gotten too comfortable. And so what they need to do is they need to now battle the left, whatever the left is at any given moment in time. And through that battle and through that struggle, they will come out of it stronger, more powerful, more capable of command, and we will have a new ruling class. Edmund Burke writes a letter to an emigre from France, an aristocrat who fled France after the revolution, and he said, you know, we're fighting this revolution, we're gonna, you know, restore power, but make no mistake about this, whatever we restore, it's going to be, in some sense, this is the phrase from Burke, something new. In other words, we're not gonna go just back to what we had before, because what we had before was pretty crappy. We're going to reinvent this old regime, and it will be more powerful and more commanding than what we had before.
That's interesting. If modern day conservatism or the conservatism ideology or philosophy begins as a reaction to the French Revolution, does leftist ideology begin with the French? Also begin with the French Revolution?
Well, that's a really good and very tough question. Historians disagree about this. Some people say it begins with the English Civil War, when you have sort of commoners claiming the rights of democracy in the 1640s in Britain. You know, I myself don't have much of a stake in that debate. So I'm gonna take a pass on answering your question because it's such a contested issue in intellectual history and the history of political thought.
But there is no question the French Revolution is of the left.
Oh, absolutely. You know, this is a real claim for the rights of commoners to control. You know, it's anti-monarchical, and the rights of commoners to govern their lives. I mean, this is you know, you see the birth of radical democratic language. And then if we think about the Haitian Revolution, which was awakened by the French Revolution, where black slaves, you know, make a claim not only for their emancipation, but for their right to govern themselves, you can see that, you know, this is really, it's what we call the age of democratic revolution. You know, this is the real birth of democracy. And by democracy, I want to make this clear because it gets back to the question of what conservatism is about. It's not simply the right of people to elect representatives or something like that, or the right of people to control their own government. It's also a kind of democratic social movement. That is to say, it's the right of people who are subordinate in all spheres of life to be able to govern themselves. There's a very famous, poignant moment. Now I'm going to switch revolutions to the American Revolution, where John Adams, you know, is off in Philadelphia, and they're thinking about this sort of new society that they're going to be. And his wife Abigail writes him and says, "Remember the ladies," and she starts talking about how this American Revolution has awakened the imagination of women. To not just be entirely subordinate to their husbands. And it freaks Adams out. And he starts writing back to her and then to his friends and thinking to himself, what have we unleashed here with this claim of, all men are created equal and these rights of these democratic rights? And that's what happens in these moments. It's that, they might begin with claims of democracy at high levels of government, but they very quickly radiate out throughout the rest of society. And that it's that radiation out that really unnerves conservatives. And Burke talks about this. He says, these claims of the French Revolution, let's make no mistake about it. Sooner or later, it's going to mean, and he starts, providing a lot, soldiers rebelling against their generals. And he even mentions the rebellion of Haitian slaves long before the Haitian Revolution even begins. So it's, and I call this the private life of power. What these revolutionary movements are disrupting is not merely how rights and privileges get arrayed in the public sphere, it's also how disruptive they can be in the private sphere, particularly in the family. And that's what conservatism is really reacts against.
Is Edmund Burke looking at the French Revolution and then I guess when you look at the French Revolution, always a main critique of it is what was known as the terror and the execution of people. Was he looking at that and then looking at Haiti afterwards as saying this is why, and maybe this is fundamental to conservative thought, we need hierarchy, we need an aristocratic class, and because without it, and maybe he even was promoting Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan, that you need a strong leader at the very top, a monarch or whatever it would be, in order to ensure order and also inevitably safety for people.
So this is a really interesting question, and people forget about Burke is that he writes The Reflections on the Revolution in France. That's his great work, his most famous work, in 1790. That's actually before the Reign of Terror.
It is before.
The Reign of Terror doesn't begin until after that. And he makes these statements about Haitian, the revolt of Haitian slaves long before the beginning of the Haitian Revolution. So all of this is kind of proleptic. He's imagining something that's going to happen in the future. But I do think what you've hit on there is very important to Burke's imagination and to all conservatives, which is that you cannot have social order without a very strict social hierarchy. So in other words, once you start seeing people saying, let's have democratic self-rule, the conservative sees just in that claim alone, which is not a claim to anarchy and it's not a claim to disorder, it's the claim of the rights of people collectively to govern themselves. The conservative sees in that not necessarily violence, but the lack of order altogether. And I think that's, they cannot imagine social order without a very strict hierarchy. And by hierarchy, they really mean the subordination of lesser beings to higher beings. And that actually, Hobbes is a whole different kettle of fish. I won't lead us astray with that. But that's really at the centerpiece that you can't have order without hierarchy at all.
It is said that the American Revolution was also influential in sparking the French Revolution, but Edmund Burke had a very different view about the American Revolution, didn't he? Wasn't he more sympathetic?
He was initially during the 1760s and the early 1770s very sympathetic to the claims of the colonists because he thought that they were part of the British Empire, that they were Englishmen. He felt like they, were represented in Parliament and were part of the the imperial project, but he was never sympathetic to the claims of the Declaration of Independence, or ultimately when it became an actual revolution. He felt like the British had kind of gotten themselves into it and it was their fault. But I think people have said, have made wildly inflated claims that somehow or another he was pro-American Revolution, and it's not quite that. But he was very sympathetic to the claims of the colonists because he viewed them much the way he viewed anybody who was part of the British polity. But that's a very different kettle of fish than being in favor of a revolution.
I want to focus more on the aristocratic class and how that plays into conservative philosophy, ideology. And we were talking about it with Edmund Burke. But I want to move forward a little bit, and I guess in a way move forward by also going back, because the word aristocrat comes from Greek. It was used in ancient Greece. And what it used to mean was of the best, and that the best should. And I think Aristotle supported this type of governing system, which the best ruled. Today, I guess aristocracy means something different, obviously. But I started to really see, I think, the argument here that you're making in reading about another 19th century philosopher that a name we'll all recognize, Friedrich Nietzsche, who also wrote about the Greek state. Now, I never thought of Nietzsche as necessarily a conservative thinker, but I also didn't realize that he vehemently opposed, we were talking about the French Commune or the French Revolution earlier, 100 years later, a little under 100 years later, he was very much against the Paris Commune.
Yeah. I mean, this is, there's a long chapter in which I talk about Nietzsche. And I think the whole question of Nietzsche is fascinating. I should preface what I'm about to say, that my argument about Nietzsche is very contested and controversial. There are a lot of people who disagree with me about this, so that you're getting, you know, my take on this. But in my reading of Nietzsche, he is squarely within the reactionary tradition of the right. And the reason people oftentimes dispute that, because he was, you know, hostile to the whole idea of religion, and he was really hostile to the German state, not initially, but with time. But I think that notion that he's not a conservative presumes that conservatives are naturally in favor of religion, and that's just simply not the case. I mean, Ayn Rand, who was one of the, you know, figures of the conservative movement in the 20th century, was an atheist. She thought religion was preposterous. But what makes Nietzsche, I think, a reactionary is precisely that he was horrified by the sort of democratic mass movements of the 19th century. And you point to the Paris Commune, which I talk about in the book. It was, you know, in some ways his kind of moment of awakening. He was scandalized by the idea of these Parisian commoners seizing power. And one of the things that so scandalized him was that he felt like cultural greatness, or just cultural, any kind of culture, really requires the subordination, often cruel subordination, of people at the bottom, particularly laborers. And he was one of the most far-seeing figures of the right, because he really saw in the second half of the 19th century the way labor was making claims for itself and was horrified by it. I mean, he felt like the entire culture would be degraded.
Because he thought only the great men, I guess, were capable of contributing artistically and culturally to society.
Yeah, and there was something about the idea of the laborer that he felt, you know, really degraded that entire idea of the great man. I mean, these were people who worked with their hands, and they were, you know, slaves to their body and their bodily needs. And he thought, you know, how could you ever create, the way you create great culture is precisely by suppressing and exploiting labor, not by emancipating it. And so that, you know, that, and he, you know, he was scandalized by socialism, he was scandalized by the labor movements, and what made him such a great figure on the right and so interesting is that he ultimately traces all of that, these democratic movements, back to religion itself, to Christianity and Judaism. And he thinks that's the original sin, really, is religion, because it elevated the commoner to think of themselves as worthy of God, and so that's why his critique of religion is so far-reaching, because he thinks there's in some ways almost a straight line from religion to socialism, and really wants to dispense with religion altogether, in part, I mean, there's a lot of different reasons there, but in part because he sees it as contributing to all these sort of democratic waves of emancipation in the 19th century.
And Nietzsche is looking back at ancient Greece, and he's getting, you know, in ancient Greece, it may have been the first democracy in the Western world, but it only for at its height, 40% of the people who lived in Greece, whereas, you know, there were many slaves at the time. He looked back at that period of time as saying you need the commoners to be able to do all the manual work so that the people, the great people, don't have to worry themselves with everyday existence, but then can strive for excellence, I suppose.
Exactly. That you had to, you know, you needed laborers, whether they were slave or not, to take care of the material needs of society. But they could not have any claim on that society. So they needed to really provide for the better people. And, you know, Nietzsche, you know, again, people, I sometimes think he's being ironic or they're scandalized when he says it, but he really took this idea quite seriously. And what's interesting, you know, he writes a lot of this stuff about slavery and the importance of slavery to culture. He starts writing about this in the early 1870s. And don't forget, you know, what's going on around him. African people of African descent had been just emancipated 6 years prior in the New World. And Nietzsche had followed this. You know, he writes in his diaries about people like Harriet Beecher Stowe, who he was nauseated by. So there's, you know, and that, you know, there had been also movements to emancipate the serfs in Russia, and he was certainly aware of that. And in Prussia, you know, a bonded labor had only been ended, you know, a generation prior. So labor in the 19th century is being emancipated in all kinds of ways. And the Paris Commune was really the work of, you know, French laborers, Parisian laborers. And so he sees this class of people making claims on the society as a whole, both for themselves and on the society. And he really feels like this is a crisis for Western civilization and Western culture as a whole. And that we need, we being, you know, the sort of superior forces, we need a new kind of philosophy that's completely unsentimental and a-religious, that will sort of make hierarchy and domination not a kind of an embarrassment, but the centerpiece of society as a whole.
We are in conversation with Corey Robin. He teaches political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. We are talking about the history of conservative thought. He's the author of the book, The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Donald Trump. Corey Robin, I couldn't help but, again, in preparing for our conversation, suddenly seeing this line that went from Nietzsche to Ayn Rand.
Yeah, so I have a long chapter in the book on Ayn Rand. You know, she was, in fact, an avid reader of Nietzsche. I think when she came to the United States in 1926, 1927, one of the first books in English that she bought was Thus Spake Zarathustra. I won't say she's the most sophisticated reader of Nietzsche. There's a lot more going on in Nietzsche. But she certainly clued into a couple of things, one being this sense that religion and Christianity in particular, that there's a real threat in Christianity that is an attack on the whole idea of superior beings. And she really wanted to, you know, dispense with religion altogether because she thought it induced a kind of humanitarianism and sentimentality about the laboring poor and so forth. So there was that element. And she was very much, for a period of time, she ultimately walks away from this, but was very enthralled with the idea of the criminal, this kind of person, this transgressor, who's willing to defy the norms of society for the sake of a kind of more exalted vision. That, you know, the film, the Hitchcock film Rope, which was based on the Leopold and Loeb case in Chicago about, you know, these two young men who had kind of read Nietzsche and his ideas of the Superman, and they take that to mean that, you know, you should be able to do something daring and transgressive, like kill another human being. She was quite taken with that idea for a while. But what's interesting about Rand is the way she translates these, I mean, I'll call them, let's say, vulgar Nietzschean ideas into a defense of capitalism. Now, Nietzsche, for all of his hostility to socialism and labor, the labor unions and so forth, Nietzsche was equally hostile to capitalism. He thought it was a really pedestrian social system, that the bourgeoisie should not be the ones in charge of society because they were too grubby and money-minded. You know, his idea of the superior man was the sort of artist or the warrior. The capitalist was kind of, you know, second best. But what Rand does is to translate some of those ideas of, you know, the superior man, the great man, and all the rest of it to the capitalist realm. And so she sees, famously in the Fountainhead, Howard Roark, this architect, as this kind of figure, and then also in Atlas Shrugged, these industrialists, these titans, as kind of these superior men who are, through their commercial enterprises, their economic enterprises, creating a kind of new form of life, much in the way that Nietzsche had hoped philosophers or warriors or artists would. So what she represents is, you know, a kind of economic Nietzscheanism. And I think that's really important because in many ways that reflects the broader philosophy, particularly of the American right in the post-war era, that they see, these economic magnates, these industrial titans, as kind of the natural leaders of society. And here we come to someone like Donald Trump. I mean, if you read The Art of the Deal, which I read, he really sees society as being presided over by the men of money, the great men of money. And he thinks of himself as one of them. And that vision of, you know, the sort of economic Nietzscheanism, I think really is at the heart of the modern American right in many ways.
I mean, does this just boil down to a fundamental tenet, I guess, or a pillar of conservative thought is aristocratic rule?
Absolutely. But again, I think it's very important to stress that what marks modern, you know, American conservatism in the post-war era is, you know, this idea that you find those aristocratic rulers not at the helm of the state necessarily, not in the church, but at the top of the capitalist economy, that they are the real rulers of society. And that, you know, that's, again, not something that Nietzsche really had in mind, or even Burke, whose ideas about capitalism were slightly more complicated than most people realize. But it wasn't really where he saw sort of the natural aristocracy or the natural rulers of society. So that's one of the ways in which modern American conservatism has really shifted. It's the elevation of the businessman, really, as the great man of society.
And how does that get us then to say, I guess, Barry Goldwater and then the populist aspect of the conservative movement here in America?
So this is really an interesting aspect, which is, you know, as you say, for all the aristocratic and all the elitist dimensions of conservatism, there's also the flip side of it, which is the populist elements of conservatism. Now, those populist elements don't need to be in conflict or in tension with the elitist elements. And historically, what's been so fascinating about the right is how it's been able to reconcile those, the elitism and the populism. I think the most familiar and obvious way comes out of the slaveholder South. What the sort of the master class of the South, the white master class, understood was that in order to maintain slavery, they needed to have the allegiance and support of all white people, even of people who weren't slaveholders. And remember, you know, owning a slave, that was an expensive proposition. It wasn't something that anybody could do. So what the American slaveholders, the master class, did was they went at this in one of two ways. One was to try to make it possible for every white man to own a slave. So there were actually proposals, believe it or not, in the Old South to give tax subsidies and tax breaks to make it possible for every white man to own a slave. They didn't get there. I mean, I think at the height there were maybe 400,000 slaveholders, which interestingly enough, however, is much more, you know, shows you how much more widespread slaveholding was in the United States than it was in other slave societies. But it still wasn't every white man. So that was one way. But the other way, which I think was much more far-seeing and far-reaching, was John C. Calhoun's plan.
He was the great defender of slavery in the 1850s.
Yes, he was definitely the real arch-theoretician and practitioner, because as he was the vice president, but of the United States. So he was a very high figure in the Democratic Party. He was Andrew Jackson's vice president for the first term. What he said was, you know, it's not that every white man has to be a slaveholder. It's just by virtue of having a white skin, you become part of the aristocratic class in the United States. So in other words, you know, he didn't invent American racism by any stretch, but I think he was one of the very first to see that the utility and value of racism is that it depicts all white people, regardless of whether they have slaves or don't, whether they're wealthy or poor, as you know, completely poor, they become an automatic aristocracy by virtue of the fact that they are rulers over black people, whether they're slaveholders or not. So white supremacy is really one of the key ways in which the right, you know, has managed to finesse this problem of elitism and populism, because you can see how it preserves the power of the slaveholder, and remember, some of these guys were really quite powerful, but it also democratizes that power, at least symbolically, by making all whites part of, in a sense, all whites become part of the master class or the ruling race, which is the title of a book about slavery.
And you would, I imagine, argue that this dynamic is alive today, but maybe coded, maybe not so obvious. But you cite and you quote Lee Atwater, a former Republican strategist.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to do the quote here because it's such an ugly quote. But Lee Atwater, who, you know, was George, the campaign manager, main campaign, not manager, but main campaign advisor to George H.W. Bush. Now remember, oftentimes people look at Trump and they say he's such a departure from the more genteel ways of the Republican Party, of people like George H.W. Bush. Well, like I said, Lee Atwater, and I quote him in the book, you know, was one of the people who really saw the value and utility of a very nasty kind of racism to restoring the power of the Republican Party. And he really pioneers that, sometimes in very coded language, sometimes in less coded language. And so, you know, but he wasn't the first. I mean, Barry Goldwater, a whole chapter in The Conscience of the Conservative is about states' rights and the importance of defending states' rights. And he's very clear that that's not just a code for white supremacy. It's really a way of opposing the civil rights movement. And he opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Richard Nixon is one of the, you know, the first modern backlash presidents. He oftentimes used the language of law and order, but, you know, in private was very free about speaking about how this was all, you know, the problem. I think there's a quote in there, maybe from Nixon or from Haldeman, I can't remember, about, you know, the problem. No, it's Nixon. You know, the problem really is the blacks. So, you know, racial backlash has been part and parcel. What's interesting, to jump forward about Trump, is that all of these guys, Goldwater, Nixon, and Reagan, I mean, Reagan, don't forget, launches his campaign in 1980, right near where the Neshoba, right near Neshoba, Mississippi, where the three civil rights workers were killed, and, you know, launches it with a call for states' rights. But what's interesting about all those guys is that, you know, they had to sometimes be very coded, as we were saying, about their language. I mean, it was obvious. We used the phrase dog whistles. What seems interesting to me about Trump is he dispensed with the dog whistles. He was just outright about it. And the way I read that, you know, some people say that just shows how ugly the conservative movement has become. I think it's always been ugly. But the way I read it is that it used to be a dog whistle was enough because they were riding high in power and gaining power. I think over time, and you can see this in the electoral returns over time since Nixon, they've lost power within society, the white supremacists have. And so they need something that's a little bit more aggressive and less coded and less covert, and it has to be more overt. So, you know, once you could kind of signal with a nudge and a wink, and that's no longer enough. And I think that's a function of their diminishing power, not their greater power.
And this idea of a dog whistle is explained quite clearly by Lee Atwater. I won't read the quote either, but in a nutshell, was something to the effect of, you can't campaign anymore by just repeating the N-word. You can't campaign by opposing desegregation anymore. So instead, what you have to do is you have to talk about cutting government services, because you know in the end, people understand who's that going to hurt most. That's going to hurt black people.
Right. Exactly.
Corey Robin has been our guest. Again, Corey Robin is a professor of political science at Brooklyn College and also the CUNY Graduate Center. He has joined us for a conversation on the history of conservative thought. He's the author of the book, The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Donald Trump. Corey Robin, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you greatly.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed it too.
That does it for Letters in Politics. Deanna Martinez is our producer. Lucille Rousseau is our intern. And Kirsten Thomas is our engineer. You can listen to our archive shows at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezrich, and I thank you for listening.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland, and coming right up in the house, Teresa Mitchell is here with news you're not supposed to know. It's Press Watch in just a couple of minutes. At 9:30, Fight the Empire with Per Fogering, our host. He runs down the latest with Russiagate, plus recalls his own run-in with the late Reverend Billy Graham. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Flashpoints. At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks to Micheline Aharonian-Markham about her